This season of the Lake Effect Podcast is made possible by the Randolph J. and Estelle M. Dorn Foundation.
This episode is sponsored in part by Shores and Islands, Ohio. S&IO embodies the excitement felt from the very first time you visit. Shores and Islands, Ohio. It's a sure thing. More information at shoresandislands.com.
Hey, thanks for checking out today's episode of the Lake Effect Podcast. Today, I am in Castalia, Ohio, a few miles from Sandusky Bay, talking to Mona Rutger of Back to the Wild. Mona, thanks for meeting with me today.
Thank you.
What is Back to the Wild, and are you the big boss?
Yes, I'm the executive director. I founded the center in 1990.
Okay.
It's a wildlife rehabilitation center and a nature education center, so it's twofold. We help injured wildlife and return them back into the wild where they belong, and we also educate. We have over 70,000 children and adults attend our programs.
Wow.
But school buses come daily and when the weather gets nice, and youth groups of all kinds, 4-H scouts.
What about adults? Do you have any field trips with adults?
A lot of adult stake organizations, garden clubs, Kiwanis,
no kidding.
Rotary. Many adult groups come. Sometimes buses, charter buses from outside of Cleveland and Toledo, and you know,
they swing by here.
Yeah, and they even come from out of state. One bus brought people from all over.
Really?
It was fun. It was fun to talk to them about what kind of wildlife they have in their state, and you know, yeah, there's a lot of adults.
I see a lot of mounted animals here of all types. What kind of animals do you guys have here or come through here?
We only take native wildlife.
Okay.
Other than the only exception to that is a couple tortoises we have that are from Africa.
Right.
But we only accept native wildlife. Our permits that we are required to have, our state and federal permits, don't allow us to rehabilitate something not native. In fact...
And you're talking about Division of Wildlife and Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yes, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Ohio Division of Wildlife. And the permits are very strict and monitor what we do. We don't get paid in any way, shape, or form. In fact, the permits cost us money to renew and have. But they inspect our centers to make sure we're up to their standards. We're not even allowed to take animals in from out of state.
Really?
Because once you start moving animals around, especially mammals, you can introduce viruses and bacteria into new regions.
Right.
And infect the population there who has no immunity built up to a certain virus. So you have to do it with a lot of, there's just so much criteria to be allowed to do it and to do it right.
I was here the other day and I walked in and there was a young lady and she had a possum. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would think possums are a dime a dozen. I mean, how's this possum getting special treatment? What can you say about animals that most people think are very common and who cares?
Okay, that's where education comes in. He's extremely important in our educational program. It's a possum who isn't able to go back to the wild.
So he's a permanent resident.
Yes, he's a permanent resident. They have to not be able to survive in the wild if we were to release them. So we never keep an animal that can't go back to the wild. They're the only marsupial in all of North America, the one and only. So they're extremely unique. They have adaptations that are unbelievable. They literally have little hands instead of paws. You know, they can move like fingers like we have. You know, they have opposable thumbs. They have, you know, the pouch, of course, the prehensile tail. But they're beneficial to the environment. A raccoon can do a 1,000 times more damage than a possum.
Right.
You know, the opossums are so, they just don't, destroy anything, but they benefit the environment by eating all kinds of things, you know, from dead animals to slugs and snails and mice. They eat rodents. They're just beneficial. So through education, people learn. And the best thing about them is they're being used to help develop anti-venom for snake bites.
Really?
Yeah. They're immune to venomous snakes. Nobody knows why.
I have no idea.
Totally immune. So doctors are literally creating an anti-venom, or scientists, I should say, that will help humans. Also, they have another, they're using their blood, something about human heart, I think. So I don't know, you know, I don't think anything that's here is worthless or not meant to be here for some reason. You know, it's all part of, you take something out just because it's not, you know, people consider it ugly or, you know, just not cute and cuddly or whatever. And you pull that out of that chain, that natural food chain out there, the whole chain falls apart. It affects like dominoes.
So I guess you'd say, as far as medical research goes, that there's limitless possibilities.
There you go. Possibility. That's a good one.
I know wildlife officers sometimes will bring you new patients. Who all brings animals in, and do they call first, or do you just get people that show up and pick something up off the side of the road or their backyard? Or how does
all
that work?
All of the above.
Oh, really?
The turnpike people, the state patrol, the police and fire departments, because those are who the people go to when they don't know what to do.
Right.
And they aren't equipped to rehabilitate animals, a wildlife. So then they learn where we are, and once they have your name, it's like the word spreads. And I thought the first year I'd take in like 20 or 30 animals. It went from like that first year to like 200 the next year, then 500, then 1,000. It's like once your name's out there and people finally have a place to go that really is allowed to accept the animals, you just get bombarded,
right?
Because for a lot of our animals have been coming from as far as Cincinnati because there's not enough centers around that, and they're all full and they can't take anymore.
Right.
And they say, take them back to the wild. And we get full, but we just don't want to turn anything away.
I think one of the things that Back to the Wild is known for mostly as far as the internet and traditional media and just people knowing about it is your work with eagles. Is that the most widely known?
Yeah, I think so. It's, you know, people are very enamored by bald eagles. They can't get enough of them. And, you know, we get all kinds of calls from kids wanting to do their Eagle Scout project and do something for the eagles here, or school projects, photographers. Anything to do with eagles, kids in school choosing an animal to write a report about.
Right. So photographers would want to come here and take photos of eagles.
Oh, yes.
Do you let them know that they're like pigeons in this area? They could find one
we are
anywhere.
In the densest population of bald eagles in the whole state, you know, just because of location.
Right.
The marshes and the lake offer them perfect habitat. They're fish eagles. Bald eagles are fish eagles, so they love the lake and the marshes. Although they're not that choosy, they're starting to eat more roadkill, more mammals in their diet, because they have to. They have to adapt. There's so many eagles that they're moving inland and following rivers and streams, and the fish aren't as plentiful. So somebody called last week and was upset because they watch an eagle pull a squirrel off a tree, you know.
You'll have that.
So they will do that. But
you mean they called you to
yeah, do
complain
something about
or
it.
Do something? Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Like, we can't interfere with that. You know, that's nature, the food chain. We're not allowed to harm the eagle or relocate it or
right.
anything. It wouldn't help anyway. They go back to wherever they want anyway, where they came from.
So when it comes to eagles, which are, I guess, the largest bird around here outside of swans.
White.
Geese, maybe.
Yes. Not geese. They're even bigger than the geese. And
What other Lake Erie related birds come through your doors?
Lots of diving ducks
are oh, really?
Out there in rafts, like redheads, canvasbacks, scalps, mergansers. There's a lot of diving ducks out on the lake that we get, buffleheads.
And what brings them in? Fishing line, fishing gear, or what types of injuries?
It's weather related, but
really?
Fish line is a major problem.
I see you have a lot of it here.
But that's more like local mallards and things like that. But in the winter, like we got we got two loons in this winter already. And
from around here?
Yeah. Well, in this
not
area.
A lot of them in this area.
They're migrating. What happens is when there's bad weather, like a snow squall or this intense cold or ice storm, they get disoriented and they need to be on water. Loons and grebes. We just got a grebe in the other day. That's what I was trying to come up with. The loons and grebes can't walk on land. Their feet are located at the rear of their body, so they're divers,
right.
And they literally are stranded on ground. But in a storm, wet concrete looks like water. So they crash land on highways.
Really?
Yeah. The turnpike, they crash land on roadways and parking lots because it looks like water.
And then they're stuck.
And they're disoriented because it's a bad snowstorm or wind, and they literally are stuck. They can't walk. They have to like scoot on their belly and push with their legs, and they tear up their feet and their stomach on, their belly on the gravel or whatever they're on. They can't take off unless they have 100 foot of open water. They have to run on top of the
right.
water for 100 feet to get airborne. So you can't just throw them, in a little pond, or you can't, release them on land or anything.
Have you ever released an animal that returned?
If we release them here, they've refused to leave, like a red-tailed hawk, several. They kind of thought, oh, it's a free meal, and, they
really?
Kind of hang around. There's something called a soft release that you do where you gradually reduce how much food you're putting out for them, and, they keep coming back to eat it, and then they eventually, hopefully, would rather be free and start hunting well. But none return, like not that we know of, that the songbirds sometimes stay, but if we took them somewhere else, they don't come back here.
Right.
They usually orient to their natal grounds, kind of where they were born.
Do you ever tag or band anything that you release?
Oh, good question. Yes. I banded birds for about 30 years. Several have been recovered 11 years later, a red-tailed hawk 11 years later in Texas from here.
You're kidding.
A screech owl was found in a garage, still alive. So is that red-tail. The screech owl is about 150 miles from here. It seemed like they headed out. Birds are wanderers, and they sometimes will wander all winter and hang out together, and then as this breeding season approaches, they kind of go back to their breeding territory where they came from, and
right.
But you can find them almost anywhere. But we've had probably about 40 recoveries of birds I banded. I haven't banded eagles, but the permit doesn't allow the eagles to be banded, but they have come in banded. And most of our eagles that come in with a band on, the band is very old, very worn. And when I turn the number into the bird banding lab, which is we're obligated to do, they have come back as being 20, 25 years old.
Right.
That's how long they're, have lived. That band tells where they were born, who banded them, exactly what nest they came from. So now we have eagles here that are over 30 years old.
Really? What is the lifespan of an eagle at the high end?
In the wild, 25 years.
Really?
Is good now, but you know what? 20 years ago, it wasn't that high. It was, considerably lower because of the DDT still in the food chain
right.
and in their cells. But in captivity, a couple eagles have lived up to 52 years old.
No kidding.
And it's not uncommon for a lot of them to make it to 50.
When it comes to eagles, which is kind of your banner animal here, What's the number one injury, or what do they come in with? What's most common?
I would say power lines.
Okay.
Power line strikes, hit by cars. Those might be neck and neck.
Okay.
Fish line, lead poisoning. We're asking right now, we're writing a grant for a kit that will analyze and tell us if it's lead poisoning right away, because it will help us know how to treat them.
Right.
You give them activated charcoal that binds with, you know, and removes it from their system.
Okay.
And increases their chance of surviving. Avian flu has popped up. West Nile virus.
What do these birds and some of these other animals, what do they eat? I mean, is there eagle chow, loon chow?
No, they actually have to have fish in their diet. It's really critical and important. That is their main staple of fish. But they actually get rodents, too. We have a walk-in freezer full of rodents.
Right.
Several chest freezers of lab rats and mice that are frozen, and we thaw them. And most of our raptors have to have the whole organism. You can't just give them part of one. We can't catch wild mice and feed it to them because they may have mouth poison that they ate. You
right.
don't know if they just gobbled up some mouse or rat poison set out, and then you feed it to your bird and you kill the bird with secondary poisoning. So we have to have clean lab rats, and it costs the center about $60,000 a year just buying rodents. The eagles get fish, but you know, also some rodents. We have several fishermen who are amazingly wonderful and drive all the way here and fish for the day, and they drop off a bucket of fresh, wonderful fish. And
any particular type of fish?
All kinds.
Now, I see there's some young ladies walking around that are staff members or volunteers. Or
both.
What can you say about how you guys keep this going?
Well, it's really hard to afford the size staff we need. Again, we're not funded in any way, shape, or form. So we have some wonderful full-time staff. Some of them came as interns and worked for like a summer. And then when they graduated, they came back to see if there was an opening. So we have rehired a lot of interns that worked here. We have volunteers. They're the lifeblood of any organization. They will do anything. The problem is volunteers can't be here 40 hours a week from 8 to, you know, they can't come in and they don't want another job.
Right.
They only can volunteer maybe on their days off or something. So they're not available, and we need a staff that we know is going to be here at the medication times and the, you know, feedings. Sometimes some of the orphan babies need fed every 20 minutes.
I asked you about the lowly possum earlier, and you and he was turned out to be an ambassador of educational and permanent resident. But when it comes to rabbits and skunks and a lot of these different things that you're talking about, what's the reason? What's a mission statement, or why would you say go to all this trouble to
That's
help these
very,
animals?
That's a very, very good question, because it's very costly to put all the time into that. Rehabilitation is looked at from two different groups of people or two different thought processes. One is, in the grand scheme of things, are you really making a difference? You know, doing individual bunnies and squirrels? Not really. You know, if you didn't release...
You're not supposed to say that.
But it's true. But it makes a difference for that one.
Right.
And some people feel, a lot of people feel that, you know, who are we to pick and choose? Like, you get to live. Oh, you know, we'll just destroy you. They're all part... they were supposed to be in the food chain. Nature is going to do its job and eliminate the weak and the sick and the injured. So we try to look at it with a reasonable, you know, like if they look like they're not thriving, they're already past the point of coming back. Maybe they had genes passed on to them that weren't going to benefit the population as a whole. So we shouldn't put them back in the wild. So we have to use what we know be intelligent about it and understand, you know, how we're affecting. We can't just save every single little animal.
Right.
But there are people who are so invested in that one animal, it changes how they look at the natural world. They could end up being a rehabilitator someday just because of their experience of bringing in a single animal. You know, oh, I took a bunny there once and it impacted me so greatly, you know. And whether it's a salamander or a bald eagle, they're all equally important. Even though a lot of us can look and go, there's 1,000 rabbits out there, you know. Well, now there's a lot of eagles. Do we start just putting eagles down?
Right.
You know, there can't be too many of a predator or the prey, because what happens, it goofs up the food chain terrible. If there's too many eagles, there won't be enough prey left. So that's a good sign. The eagles are, they're indicators of the health of an environment. They warn us of the condition of the planet. If they're doing well, that means their food base is well. There's enough prey. That's a good sign. If all of a sudden there's not enough prey, then the predators start dying, you know. So it's just, I don't know. I guess I'm not probably answering your question.
No, you're sounding very philosophical.
Yeah, it is philosophical because, you know, it's like the guy that, you've probably heard the story, the guy's walking along a beach and he's bending over, old man bending over every few seconds, picking up a starfish and throwing it back into the sea. And he does that all the way down the beach. And somebody says, silly old man, you know, don't you know that, you know, that's not going to make a difference because the tide comes in and goes out every night,
right,
and strands. And he said, he throws one in. He said it made a difference for that one. But the education is so critical. And it lets all those other animals let us talk to the people about, hey, teach your kids compassion. Help connect them with the natural world. You know, most of them come in there like clueless. They didn't even know rabbits would live in their own backyard. You know, they had no idea that they're that common. It's an opportunity to say, you know, open your eyes. And, you know, this, and compassion kind of went out the window for a lot of people, and we can help.
Do you attribute some of that in recent years to the internet, cell phones, and crap like that with kids?
1,000%. I could not say more that it has everything to do with cell phones. And there's something called nature deficit disorder. It's true. It's happening, you know. There's like a break between, we grew up playing outdoors, playing in the country, you know, and not everybody was lucky enough to grow up in the country, but even in the city and the parks, and kids discovered things and found things, and that's like gone. They don't even know how to, you know, they're good at games and stuff like that, but they're out of touch with the real world.
So speaking of finances, you said you are not officially funded. You have no permanent funding source.
Correct. It's all private donations.
How do you get donations?
People walking through our door, people reading an article in the paper, seeing a release. We've had articles in probably hundreds of articles in magazines, newspapers. The school programs, parents come along on field trips, so a lot of them will make donations. But the local community foundations have been amazing. They have been very, very supportive. However, their funding is very restricted. Like, we can't just use it however we want. It's for a specific purpose. And if there's anything left over financially wise, you know, it has to be returned.
Right.
To the, and so
that's
they let us do things like, they put our handicap restroom in, the handicap walkways, so that everybody could attend our programs,
right,
you know, whether they're able to walk or not. They can use the walkways with wheelchairs. They will help in a pinch with some. They don't, you know, pay staff or utilities or things like that, operating expenses. But maybe if a roof needs replacing on a cage or an enclosure, they'll help with things like that. One foundation just donated a walk-in freezer. Thank God. Our other one was dying fast, and we didn't know what we were going to do. We're talking $25,000.
Ouch.
Veterinarians who donate their time and expertise. We have to pay a lot of vet bills, but they give us breaks and give us discounts on x-rays. They do what they can.
Have you guys ever worked with a bird that came in, maybe an eagle or something else that had been shot, ended up in a legal case where someone got in trouble?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
A few years ago, a truck was doing donuts in the parking lot of the mall over on 250 on purpose, threw a lot of gulls, like maybe 200 gulls.
Wow.
He hit over 98 of them. The state threw them in the back of the truck, drove them out here. I didn't have much of a staff then. I stayed up all night, saving what I could. Their truck was all full of blood. We cleaned it out, and I remember, we don't get paid. But the lawsuit, the person had to pay, I think, $100 for every bird that died, and something for the injured ones, and he got a hefty fine. Sometimes there's imprisonment. You can't shoot an endangered species or an eagle. Now that they're not endangered, they're still afforded the same protection. If you shoot an eagle, you go to prison. We've had to keep animals for evidence in our freezers, you know, shot ones. Oh, we've had a swan shot through the neck, and kids throwing rocks at birds and hitting them in the head, and the judges sent them here and as part of their, you know, to see what they caused, and again, compassion.
And do you guys have a website, or where can people find more information about Back to the Wild?
It's www.backtothewild.org.
Ramona, thank you so much for meeting with me today. It's been a few years since I've been out here, and it was good to hear about everything you're doing at Back to the Wild in Castalia, including talking about some of the big birds from Lake Erie and some of the ducks.
Well, thank you. I'm very honored that you, chose our center to be one of your topics.
Thanks again, young lady, and hopefully I will see you one day somewhere around the lake.
Yeah, releasing something, I hope.
Thanks for joining me for this edition of the Lake Effect Podcast. I'm your host and producer, James Proffitt. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. To hear more, go to wgte.org/lakeeffect. And I hope to see you somewhere around the lake.
WGTE. Voices around us.
This episode is sponsored in part by Shores and Islands, Ohio. S&IO embodies the excitement felt from the very first time you visit. Shores and Islands, Ohio. It's a sure thing. More information at shoresandislands.com.
This season of the Lake Effect Podcast is made possible by the Randolph J. and Estelle M. Dorn Foundation.